Morning's Distinguished Leader Series. Today we have a very interesting guest, Kelly Graziade, who was a senior exec at Facebook, who now has her own venture firm, F7 Ventures. Kelly is also a early Turing investor, so Kelly and I go way back. Kelly, welcome, and thank you for joining us today for Turing's Distinguished Speaker Series.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. And Kelly, before we start, could you tell us a little bit about your story and what you did at Facebook, how that led to F7 for everyone listening?
Absolutely. So a little bit about my story. So I've essentially been an operator. Sorry, I have a lot of notifications going off that I will try to shut down. So I have been an operator for probably about 20 years, just to age myself, from companies the size of 3 people to 300,000 people, and have primarily built and led go-to-market teams over that time period. And to go all the way back, I can take it old school to Alta Vista in the early days, to then joined Overture through the acquisition from Yahoo, and then joined Facebook many years ago in 2010. And maybe there's a number of interesting stories about my journey to Facebook, but one that I would share is that I essentially had a job offer on the product side and a job offer on the sales side. I ultimately chose the latter and built out what was the mid-market channel. So in a few short years, grew that to 150 people and $1 billion in revenue. So just an incredibly high growth, fast paced environment. I ultimately chose that because I've always cared a lot about people and teams. That's been kind of a big hallmark of my career, and also why I love that we're connecting on this topic today. After my time on the mid-market side, I actually made my way back to product, and I ran what was the product marketing team globally for monetization, so ads and commerce, and I had teams in essentially all 4 regions, and in that case managed a distributed and global team. After about 7.5, 8 years of Facebook, I finally decided that it was time to leave. I kind of had the itch to go back to something smaller. I joined Facebook. They were about 750 people. When I left, it was 40,000 plus strong. So really dramatic growth. And from there, I went and did an EIR at Foundation Capital. That's actually where Jonathan and I met, and was really trying to decide what I wanted to do next. Did I want to start a company? Did I want to go the investor path? And interestingly enough, I essentially married those two things and did both. And so I've started a venture firm with 6 other ex-Facebook leaders and operators.
It's awesome. And I didn't realize that you'd worked at Overture. Overture invented the AdWords model, right?
Yes.
So you've been like at the start of the online ads explosion, which culminated with the small company Facebook that you also that's incredible. So it's sort of like almost like the full spectrum, like the 0 to 1 of online ads.
Yes, it feels like it. It was pretty funny even when I think about, going back to my Alta Vista days. I remember being like, what's a 468 by 60? We don't even use those terms anymore. But it's definitely been an interesting journey going through that, and ultimately also, why I've loved all of this. I think all of those spots, jobs, the time was really about building something from the beginning, and loved just how undefined and greenfield. And so I feel like it's been an incredible privilege to be able to join those companies and build in those areas from early days.
Is 468 by 60 an ad unit dimensions?
It okay. is.
For the younger viewers, how ads used to be filmed.
I love it. I know it's the banner. It was the first banner ad that you would see in your browser. It was a 468 by 60.
Got it. And at Facebook, did you work with Sheryl Sandberg?
Yes, absolutely. Oh. Yeah, Sheryl's fantastic. So I think that was one of the things, there are so many learnings from my time at Facebook. And I think Sheryl was and is such a big influence on the Facebook culture. And particularly, being thoughtful about managing people, navigating your career, I think many lessons I was able to take away from working with her.
And speaking of which, I think one big shift this last year and a half has been the adoption of distributed teams, right? Like people are now comfortable with the idea of distributed teams, where you're not in one central office location, you're able to collaborate and get your work done. What was your experience like with distributed teams during your Facebook days? And and now you get to experience distributed teams through a different lens, which is the F7 portfolio companies that are getting started today. Are there any lessons that you have for founders thinking about distributed teams that draws on your experience from Facebook and the F7 portfolio companies?
Yes, that's a good question. I think there are a number of lessons in terms of managing distributed teams, managing global teams. If I think of the first two tools in the tool set, I would say you need respect and empathy. And you need to slow down and make a little time to understand those things. And so when I moved over to the product side of things, that I guess at Yahoo I had led some global teams, but I'll just speak to Facebook specifically. I mean, that I had been going from running a US-based team, stepped into a global role. And there are just, you know, I think some basics that you need to really keep in mind, things like time zones, people, you know, everyone really feeling respected that not one team or one region is always being asked to have the team meeting at midnight or the inconvenient time, that you actually rotate that so that each time zone is having to flex and give at different times. I think you also have to just be really thoughtful around reading the room, reading language differences, giving, you know, if someone's more quiet, like asking, you know, giving them the opportunity to take the floor and be heard. And so I think it just takes some of that facilitation. The other thing I would say, you know, around managing global and distributed teams is also being very clear and thoughtful in terms of goals and communication. So rolling those things out clearly, using written and spoken communication to talk about those things. And then thinking about some of the collaboration tools that you use. I mean, doing this in Facebook, we had essentially what, you know, groups and what would become Facebook Workplace, which was a really great way to facilitate that, if whether that's your tool of choice, Slack or others. I think, you know, having some of those tools day to day that you can have people communicating in real time and synchronously is really important.
Mm-hmm.
No, go ahead.
I mean, respect and empathy is like a great place to start. And in one of the things I consistently hear from founders building companies today is it's very hard to onboard people the right way to a team, particularly if you're starting a company in the last year and a half. How do you ensure that they get integrated into the team the right way? How do you ensure that people form the right relationships within their team and in the broader organization when everybody's globally distributed?
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for founders thinking about company building today and how they could be intentional about ensuring that the right kind of relationships get built inside the company?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think the word that you said that jumps out at me is around being intentional and being intentional. And I think that's one of the challenges for an early stage company. You're moving fast as a founder. You have a whole bunch of priorities, competing priorities, like the things that are filling your brain in terms of how to build a fast moving company. But what should be on that priority list as well is being very intentional about the culture from the very start, being intentional about those relationships, because I think, you know, letting any sort of negative culture run away from you at the beginning can be incredible. incredibly damaging. So it's so important to be thoughtful about that upfront. I think as a founder, you're really modeling a lot of that behavior. So how are you prioritizing one-on-one conversations? Like helping to facilitate connections between people. So creating those forums for different individuals to share their work or share their experience or learn from one another. I think, you know, facilitating those connections and conversations, or putting together that cross-functional project where you have different individuals working together. I mean, I think there's nothing more bonding than a shared experience or working towards a shared goal. But I think, again, most important is being intentional about those things and doing it from day one. The other thing I would add, which, you know, now maybe as we're, somewhat certain regions, I guess, are emerging from a pandemic, but as we move forward, I think also thinking through like when or where are those moments where people can get together in person. It doesn't need to be all the time, but I think just, you know, one couple days of people getting together can last you 12 months or longer, because I think having some of that personal interaction and understanding and bonding, quite frankly, then smooths out the long distance relationships, if you will.
Mm-hmm. That's super interesting. And when you look at the F7 portfolio, the companies that you're investing in today, how are those founders today thinking about the concept of an office, like, and at the seed stage?
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly with the year we've gone through, most if not all, I'm trying to think through, are remote and remote first. And I think there were some, you know, that had an office at the beginning of the pandemic, if you will, and then decided to go all remote as they came through that. And that's the ongoing plan. And it wasn't sort of a temporary, we're going remote and then coming back in. So, I mean, that's such a notable change from a couple years ago, where so many founders are thinking about like, how do I build a remote first team? And what are the norms? What's the communication? How do I help people feel connected to the top line goals that we're trying to reach? So I would say the other thing I see for founders is, potentially being more, more thoughtful, or what may be seen as more formal, about their communication at an earlier stage. But I think it's really important, even with a small team, like what's the all hands? What's the email that you're sending out? How are you doing one-on-one? So I think it's really important to think of that and not just sort of hope it happens and unfolds as it should.
Mm-hmm. And do your companies, how do they think about what they would do post pandemic? Like, do a lot of your founders, do they see themselves coming back to an office, or do they envision staying remote, or do you see a hybrid structure?
Yes, I mean, that'll be interesting. I mean, I think most that I've talked to, it's not not a top of the list priority to get back to an office. I think we'll see remote for a while. I think there are some thinking about, are there hybrid solutions. We're actually invested in this company, but there's a company called Cody, which is kind of an Airbnb for workspaces. And so that's an example where you don't need formal workspace, but if you want to, get together with some individuals that, live in some proximity, you can get space for a day. So I think we'll see more flexible workspace like that, much more so before we see people moving, spending that capital and moving into move into shared space.
Mm-hmm. That's super interesting. I mean, at Turing, my plan is to have a policy of work from anywhere plus meet as needed.
Yep.
And I think we have to be intentional about meeting as needed. And so, for example, with my exec team, I plan to have quarterly offsites, like bringing the entire exec team together. I think we'll periodically bring the entire sales team together. Some one-on-ones might happen in person, but having the default be work from anywhere or work from home, maybe it's the solution is to have these pop-up offices, sort of have these Airbnb for offices for those meetings. But it seems kind of wasteful, to be honest, like in the Bay Area, to have an office that's kind of sitting there for And assuming that the entire team is going to be packed there for like a 9-to-5 period. And we did some surveys internally, and the team also, everyone seems to prefer the default as working from home, or rather working from anywhere, as long as the company supports travel and to make sure when you are able to bring people together when they would like. It's hard to go back and think of a commute, like an hour and a half. what are we doing in our cars like all that time?
Oh, I know. And I feel like I commuted for 15 of my 20 years. When I joined Facebook, I lived like an hour and a half from the office. I spent over 3 hours a day in my car. So I that resonates for me. That's not a world I would want to go back to. I think on that note, the other thing that we're seeing, and it's interesting because I think some of your bigger enterprise companies are grappling with this, is at least at the, let's say 6-12 months ago, I think a little bit of the chatter I was hearing was that there would still be sort of the headquarters, but we'd give more flexibility for people that want to work remote or anywhere. I think there's an interesting conversation happening though about some of the downsides of that model, because it creates kind of a hierarchy or a two-party system. So I think we're seeing more companies that are kind of making the decision to go all remote and all distributed. So you don't create that hierarchy of people in the office versus out of the office. And so I think that's, you know, really interesting in and of itself. And then also what that means for all of the various support systems. I mean, this is something, I don't want to change our subject here, but like something we think a lot about on the F7 side. So we invest in three sectors. One of those is future of work. And it's such an interesting time because so much of the infrastructure that we would previously lean on for work is changing. And now there's going to be so much innovation and rethinking around that infrastructure from, again, how people communicate, you know, what benefits are now important to people that they used to be sort of in-office benefits. What do those look like now? How do people really feel engaged and rewarded? And what does that look like in a distributed environment? So I just think we're going to see some really interesting changes, interesting innovation to support a distributed model.
Yeah, maybe it's, and I know, mental health is one area that F7 focuses on, and that's something that we never thought about it, right? Like that would be like one of an important perk or benefit. At Turing right now, we're evaluating subscriptions to some mindfulness mental health services for our team and the broader Turing developer network. Okay. Because when you work from home, like loneliness and isolation is a big factor.
Absolutely. And to your point, that is one of the areas of focus, both on mental health, and then we also focus on connected communities, which is a bit of what you're describing, that I think, we're also going to sort of challenge like how and where we form community, because some of those traditional ways, like in the office, is no longer happening. So what are those mechanisms to help people create and feel those meaningful connections? Here's another, I'll send it to you. This is not meant to be a plug, but we're also invested in a company called PACE, which is essentially group mental health. So it's a little bit of what you're describing, and they curate small groups of people that might be founders, that could be, people looking to talk about similar life experiences and create some of that support model and that mental health model, which I think is really interesting. And to your point, people are looking for more of that and a need for more of that, because that's going to happen less. There'll be less serendipity around that in some of our environments, such as work.
Got it. And what are some interesting categories that you've seen emerge in the last year and a half as the world has shifted to distributed teams? It sounds like mental health and emphasis on that is one such area. And are there, and you mentioned connected communities, are there any other categories that you think we'll see a lot of innovation in as the future of the office moves to the cloud, for lack of a better word?
Yes, I mean, I think in general, this is kind of the extension of remote work, distributed teams, but just the gig economy in general. I mean, I think what we've seen is we're seeing an overall labor shortage. People, really looking for more flexible options from not only remote work, but like working on their own schedule and their own time. So I think we're going to see, again, that infrastructure around, if it's gig economy, creator economy, passion economy, there's a lot of different names for it. But I think that's a really interesting space that we'll see a lot more of. And then I think to your point, kind of another area around future of work that we're really passionate about is just this concept of reskilling. And so, you know, the percentage of people that are in need of new job training or reskilling as sort of our jobs and environment change is pretty dramatic. And so there's a company called FlockJ that does this specific to sales, and it's just been fascinating. A number of people that come to use FlockJ have an average income of 30 to 35K before FlockJ, average income of 75 to 85K afterwards. But I think we'll see, you know, much more in that space, which is really interesting as well. Another one to mention, sort of adjacent to, is we see sort of that remote work gig economy, but there's a company called Reed.cv, which I'm super excited about. They're sort of the LinkedIn for sort of this new generation gig economy, and where LinkedIn may be a little bit more reliant on things like labels of where you went to school or what company did you work for. Reed.cv provides you a much more dynamic way to represent your work via projects or writing or speaking. And so we, you know, feel like it sort of represents the way in which people work now. But I think those are examples where we'll continue to see a lot of interesting innovation, particularly with these trends that have really accelerated over the past 18 months.
That's super interesting, Kelly. And it's the reskilling piece is interesting because it matches exactly what we see. So for those in the audience, Turing is a platform where companies can push a button to hire remote developers from all over the world. So we have 500,000 remote developers on the platform. Companies pay as you go and work with these developers for a period of time. So we did a survey recently of our developers to see, I mean, our question was, what could we build for you to make the Turing platform more useful? Yeah. And right at the top was help with upskilling. And at Turing right now, we have initiatives that we are planning to focus on what I would call horizontal reskilling, as well as horizontal upskilling, as well as vertical upskilling. When I say horizontal, what I mean is, we have like a full stack developer on the Turing platform, let's say who's good at like front end React, back end Node, and maybe the database is MySQL. And we realize for this developer's value in the industry to go up even farther, if she also learns Flutter, she'd be much more valuable. So we want to sort of give people that feedback, A, that, hey, given your profile, if you pick up this skill, you'll become more valuable in the industry. And then you want to help them acquire that skill, either in partnership or doing some things ourselves. So that's the horizontal upskilling, where we help them up-level in sort of these adjacent areas. Mm-hmm. The vertical upskilling that we think about at Turing is, Turing internally has an engineering ladder that's similar to Facebook, like where you have an IC3, an individual contributor level 3, we have IC4, we have IC5s, we have tech leads, tech lead managers. We are asking ourselves, what can we do to accelerate a developer's journey from IC3 to IC4, IC4 to IC5? Mm-hmm. And when you ask that question, it's kind of crazy because Stanford doesn't teach a course on engineering sort of leveling up, or how to grow as an engineer, or how to grow as an engineering manager. Coursera, Udacity, Udemy, nobody teaches a course there. To me, the only way an engineer up-levels is by putting in the time at a Facebook or a Google or an Apple or an Amazon and really clocking the hours. You got to accumulate that. So we are asking ourselves, can we do any vertical upskilling to fasten a developer's growth? And it's interesting that reskilling is something that comes up in a variety of contexts. People want that growth.
Well, and it's so fascinating because if you think about like, where did people get, I mean, you're hitting upon it, like where did people get sort of that, that growth or education before? So you think about a university setting, or you think about it on the job setting, particularly for people who working at some of those bigger companies, and many of those invest in some of that development. Now, if we're at a place where I mean, already sort of the tenure in a job or with a company is getting less and less, and our people are doing more sort of gig economy type work. And it's like, okay, well, where does that development happen, or who's going to be responsible for that development? Or individuals essentially saying, I'm responsible for that development. So where do I go get that, and what does that look like? So I think we're already seeing some innovation, but I think we'll continue to see it. And I mean, I love that you're thinking about that from a touring perspective. I think that makes perfect sense around like, how do you, you know, continue to also create value for the engineers on the touring platform. And that's a great way to do it.
Yeah. And in that sense, Kelly, in the last year and a half, have you seen any interesting new tools emerge that have made it easier to operate a remote first team or a distributed team that either you've invested in or you've seen F7 companies adopt? Any new tools that make it easier than ever to operate as a distributed team?
That's a good question. I think there is a lot of innovation happening in the space. I think it still feels somewhat early in terms of like where are you seeing some of those new things get adopted. I mean, I would say on one hand, I think, you know, simplicity in certain cases wins out. One of the challenges right now is just even like the various channels that people are trying to manage, if that's from Slack to WhatsApp to email to text to Messenger. I know personally speaking, I'll be like, wait, someone reached out to me and I need to go check like six different channels to try to find it. So unfortunately, like that's one of the challenges. I don't know if there's a solution. I mean, I think all the more reason why companies need to figure out like what are the norms and what tools should people be using. All in all, I think we're seeing some cool things. I mean, we've been sort of looking at some interesting things like GatherSpace and Withso, and there's just some interesting things in that sort of virtual work environment. Super early, just interesting to see what people are doing and what's really valuable about that in terms of creating collaborative spaces. I think it's too early to tell in terms of like how sticky are those things or what really gets integrated into people's work days. But it'll be exciting to see some continued innovation in the space.
Yeah, it's super interesting. Like one of the Turing customers is building this company, Sophia.world, where they kind of have this Second Life meets the office type approach, where you're sort of in this virtual space. And it's really cool because spatially you can see kind of where people are spending their time. You can kind of see, oh, Kelly is having this meeting with the sales team. Mary is having this meeting with the engineering team. And Vijay is having this meeting with the data science team. And you can sort of navigate the office in that grid. And it's kind of interesting with people trying to imagine an office beyond like a Slack screen or beyond Slack, Zoom, Asana, and tools like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be interesting to see. And so tricky to see, like, how do you make that feel like a really lightweight, serendipitous experience versus something that, you know, that's too heavyweight to make sense. But it will be exciting to see. I mean, that's, you know, one of the other things we think a lot about is just the level of innovation that we'll see over the next 24 months, I think, will be, you know, potentially unlike anything we've seen for the last decade. It's super exciting just to see the number of new companies, the pace of innovation, and all of that really coming from what's a, you know, pretty dramatic behavioral change since early last year.
And switching topics a bit, from your time at Facebook managing globally distributed teams, are there any best practices that you would recommend tactically, operationally for founders in building and managing a distributed team in today's world, both from your Facebook experience and from what you see like your portfolio companies do well, and any pitfalls to avoid when you're managing a distributed team?
Yes, I kind of come back, and this, some of this may feel a little repetitive, but I think this idea, you know, most important for founders is be intentional and be intentional about it before you think you need to be intentional about it. And I think we see this when, you know, the pace of growth right now, but you go from a team that's been 2, 3, 4 people, and then all of a sudden they have 15 people, 20 people, et cetera. Now, how you operate as a company is really different from 3 people to even 15 people. And so, you know, I think trying to get ahead of that and really mapping out, you know, a little bit of like, what's your communication plan, which can feel awkward as a new founder, like, oh, that feels overly formal. Am I doing an all hands with 15 people? But, you can call it something different or whatnot. But I do think like really mapping out what are those touch points. You know, I really, you know, just strongly suggest prioritize, these are basics, but prioritizing one-on-ones, first as a founder and a manager of a team, making sure you're making that time. I think helping connect the dots for others to do that and really getting to know one another is really important. I think it's really important to create a culture where the leaders own the success of the entire team, not just their function or their corner of the world, but you know, really bringing a group of people together to say, collectively, we own the success of this. And of course, here are the KPIs that we're trying to hit, and empowering people to be, to bring their ideas and give them some freedom and flexibility as to how they do that. But when I think you create that ownership mentality, it helps create the sort of respect for one another. It creates more cohesion. It forces people to like talk about and understand what are one another's priorities and how do you make resource trade-offs. But those are, I think, you know, some of the things that really come to mind for me when you're creating that team and trying to create a strong environment. And then of course, as we, you know, we talked about, you know, trying to do when you can, trying to get some people together in person and creating some of those shared experiences and connections that breed long-term trust.
That's super helpful, Kelly. And speaking of one-on-ones and how important they are, what's your advice on how to have an effective one-on-one in this fully distributed world?
It's interesting. I feel like through my operator career, I've experimented with the one-on-one so many different ways. There's some basics, like have the one-on-one, be consistent. Don't change everybody's time all the time when things get crazy, because I think that then people start to feel like they're not prioritized or important. I think then there's some, you know, one of the things I ultimately landed on was try to get away from a one-on-one that's simply an update that could be an email. And one of the things, you know, I like to do, not to be heavyweight, but I would ask my team members to say, well, can you send me the update in emails before the one-on-one? And my commitment is that I will read it before the one-on-one. And then we can spend that time together on one topic or two topics that are really important. Like, what's a problem that you're facing that you want to dig in and brainstorm around? Or do you want to talk about your professional development? Or, and so I think really like setting aside that time for more meaningful discussion and not just a, here, let me sort of regurgitate my weekly update to you. So that's something I think about. And then speaking of the career development piece, the other thing I would do is to actually set aside, outside of the one-on-one, set aside some dedicated time just for a career development conversation. And just to check in, how's it going? I mean, ideally you're giving some feedback in the moment, but sometimes when things are moving really fast, it doesn't happen. So that's also a good time to say, oh, by the way, I wanted to give you feedback on XYZ that happened a week ago. So I think setting aside time for those types of conversations is also really important, all the more important in a fast-paced environment, but also I think helps people feel really valued.
Mm-hmm. And what's your cadence for one-on-ones, and what's the duration that you typically have?
Yeah, so I would typically do weekly one-on-ones in 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Got it. I like the async first update, so you kind of get the sort of the informed portion out of the way, so you can really dig into anything that really needs unblocking.
Yeah, because I think we found that before, you, by the time you just got done with the update, the one-on-one would be over.
Yeah, that makes sense. And speaking of which, where did you learn to manage distributed teams? And it sounds like we are like, Where could someone learn to become a great manager? And now it feels like we've raised the bar even higher, managing a distributed team, solving for respect, empathy, like all of those things that you mentioned. It's a whole new ball game. Like how do you get high performance from a distributed team? Where do people learn this stuff?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I feel like I learned, you know, from making mistakes, getting feedback from my team. I think the first shift is, you know, particularly if you're switching from an individual contributor to a manager. I mean, that shift is the trickiest, because typically how you're valued or how you've been successful to date is your output as an individual contributor and doing a certain kind of work. And some of the mistakes you see is when people pivot to manager, they're still trying to, like, they're ambitious and want to be successful, but they're still doing it and as an individual contributor. And then the management thing is sort of like this extra thing on the side. And so I think one of the most important things is to have this mind shift of, like, managing is actually the most important job of the jobs on your list. And that's actually how you have the most impact in the organization. That's how you get the most scale. And then thinking about what are those activities you need to prioritize as a manager. And so that's where I think it is, are those one-on-ones. And it can be easy to be like, the one-on-one is the first thing that gets canceled when things are busy. Like, don't do that. Like, that needs to be, you know, one of your top priorities. You know, how are you, you know, how have you set goals for the team? Have you enrolled people in that goal setting process? I mean, that's a good example of, you know, one of the ways you learn on the job, but you can go away as a manager and be like, great, I set the goals for our team. I sent them all out, and you didn't ask anybody on the team for their opinion or their feedback. And now no one's enrolled and they're sort of wondering, like, either where these came from or are they really part of it, you know, really a part of it. And so, you know, I think going back to your question, like, how I've learned is just, you know, really having those conversations with your team, listening, understanding what's important to them, you know, being clear on your priorities as a team and organization, but getting feedback on that and rolling people along the way, making sure they feel respected and heard. I think there can also be this, you know, fine line. One of the pitfalls for me, I probably over-rotate sometimes on the listening, and I need to move faster and make decisions. So then it's also a fine line to say, like, okay, great, thank you, I heard you. I'm gonna, you know, by tonight, I'm gonna come back and let you know, like, what I've decided and how we're moving forward. So also listening doesn't mean consensus. That's another, I think, important thing in all of it. But those are kind of some of the things that come to mind. I mean, you do learn on the job. Be reflective. When have you had managers that you thought were really great, and what is it that you liked about that you would want to implement yourself? And to also, you know, talk to other managers, like, how did they make that transition? Were there tools or things that were useful for them? But I think those are some of the top things that come to mind.
And were there any books, podcasts, mentors who had an impact on how you think about managing?
Ooh. Good question. I'm trying to think of some books that I think are valuable. I think I remember, this is maybe not as specific to management, but there's a book, it's sort of like the 30, 60, 90 day plan. I think that can always be valuable when you're making a job transition. Yeah. And so that's something that's a little bit more tactical. There's a book, Essentialism, which I really like, which is a lot around prioritization and doing what's most important. I think the other hard part about a manager is you can just try to do everything and then you're not really effective at anything. So that comes to mind for me. I feel like I'm probably forgetting some of my favorites. Those are a couple that come to mind.
Thank you, Kelly. And it's kind of fascinating how, like, managing a distributed team is, like, something, again, like, where that it almost feels like there's a gap in the educational system, right? Like, you could argue whether for managing itself, like, there is a bit of a gap. It feels like one of those things, like, as you said, you kind of learn on the job by being an IC, or you just put in the hours, make the mistakes, and learn. I wonder if there's a way to fast track people to become excellent managers, both in an engineering sense and in a more general management sense. I feel like it's almost something that's being done in a sort of a loosey-goosey apprenticeship type way, like where some people learn and are self-aware enough to know that they have blind spots and seek out those blind spots. And others are probably just sort of stumbling along at their own pace. I wonder if there's like a way larger companies have internal programs for management training and so on.
They do. I mean, I think you're seeing, I mean, similar with all the things we're describing, I think you're seeing there are some even interesting startups and new companies. I mean, someone I worked with for many years was starting a company, I think it's called Rising Team, which is essentially around some of this. It's kind of cool to manage more effectively, but I think there's also a learning component around that. So I think we'll see more in that space. And again, things external to the workforce where we've typically relied on a lot of that for that education. Hopefully what's a positive about that is that maybe like make some of that material and those tools more accessible. Whereas sometimes within a company setting, you had to sort of wait until someone deemed you ready for management. I mean, it's always one of the funny things. Early in a career, whenever you interviewed for a manager job, they'd be like, have you managed people? And they'd be like, well, I'm trying to manage people. It'd always be like, well, you can get a manager job if you've managed people. You're like, well, I need to manage people to get the manager job. So I think making some of those like tools and education more accessible will hopefully, help people that really care about, management and managing teams be able to do that more readily.
Sounds great, Kelly. And I think we have a few more minutes, and I wanted to switch to F7 and investing in general. So in the last year and a half, I think one thing that has changed is founders can now fundraise from anywhere. And I mean, remote fundraising is a thing. And when I just thought about it very recently at Turing, Turing has raised like about $52 million so far. And out of that, I just realized that more than $40 million I'd raised remotely over Zoom. So I guess now I've officially raised a lot more remotely than in person. So is it true that it's to build a big company today, it doesn't matter that you are based in Silicon Valley? Or would you say that Silicon Valley still has inherent advantages? In terms of the founders that you back, do you see more people coming from outside of Silicon Valley, or has that been no big shift?
Yes, I think it's interesting. I think maybe there may become a definition of Silicon Valley that isn't as necessarily specific to location. I think there's still something really strong in terms of the Silicon Valley network, but what we're seeing is that that's becoming more distributed. So, where people are moving to various places, whether that's Austin or Miami or New York or wherever that may be. But I think some of those networks and relationships are still really important. You probably experienced this on the fundraising side, but I mean, it's still very much a business of like, who did you work with that somebody else knows that can say, Jonathan's fantastic, like you have to invest in touring and like he's gonna build a fantastic, incredible business and he's thoughtful. And so it's still something that relies heavily on those sort of recommendations and trusted relationships. But I think as I say that will hopefully expand over time. And again, it's less about place and it's more about the sort of this ethos and network of who you've worked with in tech. And it's not because you had coffee in Palo Alto, but you've gotten to know each other or work together in different ways. So that's a little bit how I think about it. And then the other good news is that what we're experiencing is enabling us to expand and establish those networks beyond Silicon Valley faster than ever before.
And the million-dollar question, like, would you post-pandemic, or like, what is your default going to be? Would it be a Zoom meeting for a first-time founder, or would it be an in-person meeting?
Oh, good question. I mean, there's pros and cons to both. I mean, the great news about Zoom is you can do however many meetings in a day, so you can just do a lot more volume. And then so sort of at the same time, like in person, you get some more like richness in terms of the relationship and some of the side conversations that are just a little bit harder to have over Zoom. So maybe it's the first meetings are on Zoom and the second meetings are in person.
That sounds great. And Kelly, you've started you started F7 Ventures, and to everyone listening, Kelly and a team of early Facebook execs started F7 Ventures, which is an early stage venture fund. Kelly, could you talk a little bit about what areas you invest in and where people can go to learn more?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for asking. So for F7, we're focused on pre-seed and seed stage companies. We look for super scrappy founders. So we typically invest kind of post MVP pre-revenue. There's really three sectors that we focused on and that we're focused on that we're kind of doubling down, particularly with the events of the past 18 months. I've mentioned a couple of them, but future of work is one. With a particular focus on the worker and some of the trends we've been talking about. The second is mental and physical health. And then the third is connected communities. And we see a fair amount of crossover between communities and health and communities and work. But those are essentially our primary focus areas. And then if you want to learn more, you could go, we're f7ventures.com. We're on Twitter at F7 Ventures, but don't hesitate to reach out if there's something we can be helpful with. I think the last thing I would add, you know, one of our big motivations for doing this was to take our depth of operating experience and translate that in a way that, you know, hopefully is really helpful to early stage founders. We've all built and scaled in really fast paced environments. We've also made a lot of mistakes. And so we're just really motivated to be a partner that is a trusted partner. You don't have to posture your position, and we'll also roll up our sleeves and help both when things are great and also when problems arise. So that's a big part of what we do.
Awesome. Thank you, Kelly. And for everyone listening, I can personally vouch for that. Kelly's been a phenomenal partner investor as we've grown Turing, and she and her team can help you scale and build a big company. From her experience, helping scale this relatively small company that you might not have heard of, Facebook. So you should definitely go to f7ventures.com if you are building a company in the future of work, mental health, or connected community space. Thank you, Kelly, for being on Turing's Distinguished Leaders speaker series. And this will be super helpful for all the companies building on Turing and many companies building outside of Turing. If you're building outside of Turing, we should build on Turing.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, thank you, Jonathan. So good to connect, as always.
Awesome. Thank you, Kelly.